Psychology, embracing creative and resourceful approaches to psychotherapy with author and therapist, Dr. Paul J. Leslie.
Welcome to Potential Not Pathology, where we offer information and inspiration for mental health therapists who are interested in learning and applying unique therapeutic techniques and concepts into their work. With a focus on the potential each client brings to his or her therapy session, this program examines ideas and tools which can assist your clients on their journey toward healing. In this episode today, we get to have a wonderful conversation with Steve Hoskinson. Stephen Hoskinson is the founder and chief compassion officer of Organic Intelligence, which is a positive psychology fractal method known for its implicit exposure approach to trauma. It's mindfulness-based, and it's used around the world by many engaged in the fields of interpersonal neurobiology, resiliency, and the recovery fields. Steve's trained thousands of individuals in the helping professions all over the world, and he is trained with such renowned therapists as Peter Levine and Stephen Gilligan, among many others. Our discussion today, I really enjoyed because it got to focus on utilizing kind of a systems approach to trauma and therapy in general. We talk about systems theory and how it can be applied to psychotherapy in order to uncover resources for clients. We talked about what is really wrong is the focus of what is wrong. And if that doesn't make sense, it will once we get to talking. We really enjoyed the discussion on the role of context and framing and feedback in interacting with our clients and how taking a second-order view of the therapy interaction can really aid us in pulling up curiosity and just this ability to access these resources and resiliency within our clients. We discuss why it's sometimes important to act in order to know instead of know in order to act, and overall how he approaches seeing the trauma work that he does as part of a bigger, larger system that often gets ignored in a lot of the literature when talking about therapy and treatments. So I hope you enjoy this wonderful conversation. I had a blast, and hopefully he did too. This is our discussion with Stephen Hoskinson. Okay. Stephen Hoskinson, welcome to Potential Not Pathology.
Thanks so much, Dr. Leslie.
Yeah. Well, I'm really happy that you and I could get to a chat because we met at the Brief Therapy Conference, and we were attending the same workshop on kind of the history background of systemic therapy. And I get so jazzed when I get to talk to people who have that similar interest as mine. So I appreciate you talking to me today.
I feel exactly the same. Yeah. It's so good to be able to hear these perspectives. And one of the things that came out, you know, during that conversation really was, you know, this question about how is it that the system perspective has kind of lost ground in some ways? And what does that mean for the future of therapy and systems understanding in general?
Yeah, I agree. And we're going to chat about that. First, I want people who might not know you kind of to get an idea of you know, what do you do, how you came, your journey to be a therapist, to work in the field. I mean, what brought you into this?
You know, I did my undergrad there in North Carolina at Wake Forest and really began to study some neuroscience at the time, as well as really looking at wisdom traditions and contemplative process. And went from there to study clinical psych here in Southern California at Fuller in Pasadena. And that's really looking at the integration of these psychotherapeutic contexts with the larger questions of meaning and existence. And so I really at that time then began to delve into more systems-framed work, working with family systems, And then that led, as it has probably for many of us, to the work of Milton Erickson, Jay Haley, the Mental Research Institute, and Gregory Bateson, and others, and worked also and studied with virtually all of the major Ericksonian teachers, and including being here in Encinitas and hanging out with Stephen Gilligan in that way.
Right.
So, yes, much of that journey has been so key. And yeah, I remember reading Uncommon Therapy and it just blowing my mind.
Yeah.
You know, just what is he doing? Because I came up in a really, you know, very dogmatic sort of orthodox kind of psychodynamically oriented perspective. And just rounding that out with this view to the strategic interventions and the larger system understanding within the context, too, of these altered states of hypnosis and the tremendous potential of that that Erickson was such a genius at.
Yeah, and it truly, truly was able to see things that most people at that time were just unable to see.
Yes. Yes, mm-hmm. It's true. And, yeah. And you know, so much of that still is a matter of training, which I do a lot of, and I'm sure you do too, that mm-hmm. To be able to practice enough, seeing, say, the somatic sphere, the biology in its interpersonal context, you know, there's so many nested layers of perspectives to keep track of. It takes some years, you know, really to practice it enough to be able to hold as many of these frames of reference simultaneously as possible.
Right. Yeah. So I notice a big chunk of your work lately is helping people move beyond trauma and foster resiliency. Mm-hmm. And when I was looking at your website, this one phrase jumped out at me, and I'm like, yes, exactly. That's exactly what I've been saying forever. And here's the phrase. What is wrong is the focus of what is wrong.
Yep.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, it's catchy, ain't it? yeah, what's wrong is the focus on what's wrong, the what's wrong attention. You know, it really goes back to this this understanding that, you know, the brain's amygdala basically is the smoke detector of the brain. And it is really good at helping us out in emergency situations and sending us these signals. If there's something wrong in the environment, it'll go off. It'll send the signal and alert our attention to find out what's the source of what's wrong right now. And then the problem is, for many different reasons, that signal continues to be sent in the absence of actual threat, which means it primes the attention into the environment to see and search for what is wrong. And so with that priming, the attention goes for what's wrong and does what I think is really the fly in the ointment of therapy, which is that it sends and reinforces high intensity experience. Because if we feel like something is wrong, we either find it and project it, or we don't find it, then we've really got something wrong, which is I can't find the thing that's wrong, but I know that there is a threat out there.
Yeah.
And that just intensifies people's situation. But our systems are meant to sort of, you know, do these cycles of activation, deactivation. But what is key for me is that those high intensity activation, deactivations are really addictive, basically, because it's really calling upon the reinforcement pattern that's negative reinforcement, basically. It feels so much better after it stops feeling worse first. So mm-hmm. if our clients are sort of run through, say, in trauma, an exposure protocol, or they are sort of dragged through the intensity of the experience of, say, attachment scenarios or trauma otherwise, that really, through state specificity, state dependency, is going to activate the system. And mm-hmm. activate it enough so that when it comes down, it's going to feel a lot better when it deactivates and the person gets support. But it does this really insidious conditioning, which says the way to feel better is by feeling worse first.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the negative reinforcement. So what organic intelligence is training folks to do is to really see kind of an aggregate of the biological operations – and begin to work back toward a more exclusively positive reinforcement framework in a shaping paradigm, which, I mean, is well established in science as being the most potent reinforcement framework for changing complex behavior.
Yeah. And setting the framework and just even setting the frame of where to focus, you know, is, I even wonder sometimes if just by saying, okay, we're going to do work on trauma and we're going to focus in therapy, we're already setting a frame of interaction.
Oh, that's so correct. That's so correct. And we know from, you know, from systems theory, including chaos theory, that our systems are sensitive to initial conditions. And
yes.
So if we set that initial condition to be trauma, everything that unfolds from that point is going to be really painted somehow with that brush. Mm-hmm. So that's why I really use this approach beyond trauma and this notion of organic intelligence, which then says, you know, our biological systems under the right conditions can be self-organizing. And we really set that as the frame within a mindfulness context. The basic frame is here and now awareness. And with that, I'm connecting to the environment through the senses. And I find that the environment is fairly neutral in response in most conditions. And that means my brainstem can stop registering with the amygdala, the what's wrong process, and come back to what is. And that's an important sort of pattern interrupt, I think, in and of itself.
Yeah. But, you know, just thinking of context and framing, it's the other day I was reading an excerpt from Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones, his autobiography. Mm-hmm. And it was something about, he said he never had a drug problem. He just had a police problem.
Yeah, right.
What an amazing way to, you know, think of the context and the frame. So whatever's coming into the system in that context of this is a police problem. It's not a drug problem. It's a police problem.
Yes.
So what you're kind of saying, at least what I'm hearing is when you're in your work, you're moving beyond therapy. It's not beyond trauma in therapy. It's not a trauma problem.
Yes.
It's you're setting this new context for new possibilities.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And really priming for that expectation that the attention can reside in the here and now and that the system can be self-organizing. And that in itself just communicates volumes to people. For instance, like your website, just saying potential, not pathology. That just lays out the frame that says, okay, our system is ready to unfold and grow. And how can I be curious enough to engage in that process?
Right. Yeah. Well, at the same time, do you feel kind of when you're doing work, you get people who come to train with you and learn from you, that you have to kind of like a Zen master get them to unlearn so that they can unlearn in order to learn? Because we get from our psychology background, so much of our framing and focus is on doing things that's a lot of times just makes that feedback continuous, and we think we're helping and we're not, and then nobody's getting better, and then we're getting frustrated thinking that there's something, there's resistance or secondary gain or all these labels we come up with. So are you kind of when you're teaching, trying to deprogram as well as program?
It's so true. It's you know, one of the things that that I really like about the Ericksonian approach is sort of this future orientation notion.
Uh-huh.
and really looking forward into the potential, into the possibility, into what can be. And I think that's a specific state. I mentioned sort of curiosity, you know, which is such a large theme in our work. This curiosity about what might be happening or what might emerge. And in some ways, that's a projective process. And if we can prime a system to be expectant of something interesting and some learning in the process, then I think we really have a leg up. And that does mean a certain amount of letting go and reprogramming the way that I prime or present expectations within my own experience. You know, we learn shortcuts. You know, I remember, you know, when I was really learning this, having to determine at one point that I was absolutely going to sit in my chair and not say a word until this irresistible impulse sort of came by. because I had my shtick. You know, I had my psychodynamic formulations. I had the interpretations ready. I was busy, you know, trying to get the object relations scenario laid out. And I had to do something different. And it is a bit of a challenge in the training environment. How do we support people enough to let go to what is familiar, comfortable, and has, you know, served us to some extent in the past? And before I get to the new place, you know, it can be a little uncomfortable. Gurdjieff would call this like being between the two chairs, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's no place, no landing place, either in front or behind at some point. And what I find is if we can get together in that in this big boat of we're all in the same boat, then I can somehow take comfort in the fact that we are all sharing this this unknowing. We're all sharing this ignorance. And I'll sometimes quote Mark Twain on this, because he said at one point, you know, I'd rather have my own ignorance than another person's wisdom because I have so much more of it. such a classic American saying.
Yeah. Well, but you know, as you're saying that, you know, what's coming up for me is we're taught so often in our training, you know, to the going into the expert role that, you know, a lot, and sometimes our clients are expecting, you know, us to be the expert and to know, and just being comfortable at times where we don't know. That's difficult. I find that if I just sit patiently enough, eventually, you know, something will open up. But in the meantime, that maybe my amygdala is going like, you got to do something. You got to help these people. You got to do something. And, you know, what do we do? So how do you kind of deal with that sitting comfortably right in the middle, as Erickson said, right in the middle of nowhere?
Yeah, you know, that's so true. I guess part of it is just getting experience with recognizing that voice, like, oh, you got to do something, or recognizing that state, oh, you got to get in there and make something happen. So part of it is just, you know, sitting there long enough to wear away the potency of that response. But the other is that I really enjoy now the kind of rapport that comes from two people sitting together in not knowing. And I do have certain expertise, but it's that it's the expertise that says their system is going to produce something valuable for them, but I don't know what it is and they don't know what it is. And in that, we both sit together and we can look together at that situation in which the solution will arise from within that person, from within that system, not from within the therapist. And that's incredibly egalitarian and liberating for me at the same time, because I don't have to come up with anything fancy. All I have to do is keep my eyes and ears open and see something intelligent that arises. And I can usually recognize it when it comes up.
Yeah. Since we started kind of discussing kind of working systemically and looking at bigger contexts and things like that, one of the things that has troubled me a lot about research into the field of therapy lately is that the emphasis has shifted from the interaction and is now more on the technique. And it's like that when we're doing these research on researching on the different methods, we're forgetting that there's a therapist in the room. Mm-hmm. And what are your thoughts about kind of that? I'm going to use a technical jargon, second order cybernetic kind of interaction, to where, you know, we're a part of all of this, and so in order to create a change, we need to change ourselves first.
Yeah, boy, isn't that the thing, you know? I'm thinking back to, you know, the research from Carl Rogers, you know, and looking at sort of empathy, congruence, unconditional positive regard as being key relational, contextual components to whatever therapy is happening, or Eugene Genlin, you know, who would look at research and look at, say, the notion of felt sense as being a key, and also relationally informed component. And I'm a little bemused as well that the full context isn't being taken into consideration in that way. And at the same time, from my approach, you know, I'm also looking very keenly into a system that is a biological system, and just shifting frames of reference pretty readily. Mm-hmm. I went last week to get my eyes checked, and you know how they're shifting those little lenses in front of you, going, is it clear number one, right. clear right. number two, and I feel like I have this very interesting job of being able to put on different lenses and see from different perspectives. You know, it's kind of the system thing that you may look at the individual biological, then may pull way back into the cultural or the immediate interpersonal or the family system or a larger social interaction or so on. And so, you know, clinically speaking, that works really well. And then the challenge, of course, is then to translate those concepts and into a testable hypothesis, you know, in research. So I'm happy to be a clinician, to be informed by research, and I'm really happy right now not to have to think of clinical protocols to research those topics.
Yeah, spot on. Yeah. Well, when we're looking at things systemically, I think that's something that seemed to, in the 70s, maybe the 80s, 1970s, 1980s, there was more of, but I've unfortunately, at least here in the United States, sensed a moving away from seeing a larger interconnection among, you know, families, among, you know, like you say, social, cultural aspects. And I'm even wondering, people I've talked to coming out of marriage and family therapy programs, and they say they're systemic therapists. They don't even know who Gregory Bateson is. And it's just, you know, it's become CBT with families. Even I think Mnuchin wondered aloud, where's the family and family therapy? Mm. And have you found that people who come to you for training and that you're interacting with, when you kind of share this insight of how to work systemically, not, like I say, not just biologically or interpersonally or social culturally, that actually increases options and potential for resources? Do they get really excited and the light goes on and they go, aha?
No, not so much.
Oh, you're down.
Sorry. you know, but people hang in there, you know, I think this perspective is so elusive in a way. I think some of this individualist perspective and focus has to do, unfortunately, with the stress and the increasing stress in the environment and the social environment and the natural environment and so on, with global climate change and so on, these questions, and I think people's systems become increasingly, the baseline activation level is increasing. And when we're talking about trauma, then what we're talking about is either fight, flight, or freeze. And freeze, for instance, is notoriously disoriented. Folks are kind of dissociated, kind of out of its space. You can't really make heads or tails of things. Or in the fight or flight process, that's more sympathetic arousal. And that means, in a way, more like laser-like focus. Sympathetic system is really good at picking out, like, that figure ground distinction. The sympathetic system really amps up that individual discrete attentional focus, and somehow I think we see the world in that kind of digital way with that kind of arousal. And I think some of our individualist focus and corresponding lack of social engagement is due to our biologies that are under significant stress in the modern period.
And that creates a loop, because then if we're getting from the environment, our biology goes up, we actually then create outside of ourselves stress, and we just get locked in this pattern, don't we?
We sure do. We sure do. Uh-huh. It's epidemic, and it's really laid on what I think is a larger contextual disturbance, which is, you know, our species is now existing apart from what our biology expects. You know, we really grew up, if you will, evolutionarily as hunter-gatherers, you know, as in small tribal groups, And we have since, what, like 15,000 years ago, really with the domestication of plants and animals, developed larger city-states and population centers where mutuality and relationship is untraceable. You know, if you look to the recent economic crisis, we see that cheating basically pays. But if we're in a small group, in a small tribal group, cheating doesn't pay because there is payback if you're trying to get away with something.
Mm-hmm. So looking at a greater context, I guess, when you're sitting with someone, they come in, how do you get a starting point? Because I know when I've talked to and taught workshops and we kind of talk about these kind of a systemic view of interaction, sometimes folks say, well, I kind of get overwhelmed because it's like, I give you an example. Someone who's never worked with families will tell me, how do you work with families? I would just get overwhelmed. And I'm thinking, I get overwhelmed sometimes with an individual more than a family. Mm-hmm. You know, so again, it's context and what we're dealing with. So when you sit down with a client, how do you keep from getting overwhelmed, but yet also hold that big picture?
Yeah, you know, I'm insatiably curious, and I tend to enjoy people quite a lot. And that's really a saving grace because I'm actually genuinely, typically interested in people and their experience. And again, there is this priming that is within me that says there is a nascent impulse of potential, of growth and coherence that is going to come out. And I'm just curious as all get out about when that's going to come out, how it's going to come out, what it's going to look like, and how then we can engage in such a way that the person begins to experience it and embody it and get to enjoy their own evolutionary process. So that that expectation, that priming, you know, really in the direction of organic intelligence or potential, I think is one of the big ways that I do it. The other is that, you know, when you've been doing this stuff for a while, you're having to work less hard. You kind of learn some ways of doing it, and it becomes then a little bit of a, instead of a practice of the scales, it becomes jazz. You know, it becomes this very interesting free-form conversation of mutual interest that is, you know, really I'm orienting myself to the well-being of the client. And within that, I feel like I have quite a bit of range to explore all of the aspects of living that may be relevant to that person's associative network in the moment. So we're going to have, and I'll train my students in this free association conversation and really begin to leaning heavily really on the interpersonal side of things, you know, and really then listening for the projections, listening for the projections that are not only, you know, I think it was D.H. Lawrence who characterized the Freudian unconscious as this. He said, the Freudian unconscious is the cellar in which the mind keeps its bastard spawn. The cellar in which the mind keeps its bastard spawn. And that's if you don't mind me saying, that's a hell of a priming. To expect that what's going to come out of the unconscious is, you know, these mutant zombies from the cellar or something, you know, right? Those nasty little id impulses, you know, or, you know, whatever. Right. And if instead we are expectant and priming for this movement of organization and we have some sense refined and defined by, you know, state-of-the-art neuroscience, what that might look like, then when it happens, I can do because I'm primed, I'm ready, I do a very immediate and emotively spontaneous reinforcement on that. And and that takes a little while to be able to respond instinctively in that way, but it's really key for the reinforcement because it's got to be timed well. I tell people that one of the differences between what I do and what you might find in other places isn't so much in what the intervention is, but the timing of it, you know, and its intention.
You know, as you're saying that, I'm kind of reminded of Heinz von Forster's comment, act in order to know. Yeah. And I think that we all seem to want to know before we act. And what I'm hearing is, yeah, I got a plan, but it is so wide open. And how did you learn to become comfortable with a wide open plan?
Well, it took a long time to dispense with the maps that I felt weren't achieving what I wanted to achieve. So, you know, I still look, you know, with the lens of, say, a family system. I still look with the lens of the psychodynamic perspective. I still mm-hmm. look with the lens of the systems. But I really lean heavily in the complexity sciences about the nature of phases and phase transitions. And I'm watching that biology for that. And also really, you know, I spent a lot of time doing projective testing. You know, like when you're showing a Rorschach card, the specific question is very intentional. It's not what does this look like or what is this? It's what might this be?
Might this be, right?
And in many ways, over and over again, I'm asking that question. What might that be? What might be involved here? What comes to mind as you think of that? And really, mm-hmm. really opening the field so that we can have this unselfconscious conversation with the client as much as possible. Because once that unselfconscious, once the self-conscious inhibition comes off, then the psyche really begins to speak its mind, if you will, and then we're really in the rich field of, you know, psychic development.
Right. Well, when you're kind of sitting with somebody and you're just mentioning, using your term, the field, what do you think when you're sitting with that person, if there had to be one thing you tell a clinician, one thing about sitting in that field, what do you think the most important thing would be?
I think it would be to remain somehow conscious of the physical environment, to come back to one's senses, to have some level of background awareness, maybe some significant level of background awareness through sight and sound and smell and the tactile sense. I think it's too easy to get lost in our preconceived notions and become less than present, and that level of presence that is orientation to the environment through the senses is our barometer of how in the moment I am. And so somehow that would be my trick. And by the way, I think that really primes for, in our own biology, this curiosity and this state which this preeminent sort of psychophysiologist Stephen Porges would call the ventral vagal state, this more engaged state, and this less withdrawn, less preoccupied state. So I think there's a lot of benefit to the notion of being in the here and now, but the here and now is being defined as some baseline awareness of the physical environment.
Mm-hmm. How do you, when you're teaching or training people, how do you get them to focus on resources that, I mean, it's so easy to get hypnotized by the problem. How do you help your students to learn that, you know, there's this greater field and you know, the interaction and all that? What's the best way you found to kind of remind people to kind of move away from that pathology focus?
Well, you know, I have a specific protocol that really looks at that begins with the notion of orientation, and then that's a diagnostic for me as well when we're working with clients. How well actually the person can get the attention into the exterior environment. Now that's just how well that happens is an immediate and most potent measurement of a biological resilience. But the second is how readily can the individual sustain attention to positive affect or positive sensation or positive cognition? How long that attention can reside effortlessly in positive experience is also diagnostic. So we just have people go out there and try it and train in it and see if they can hang out with it. And people are typically pretty surprised at how quickly that happens. Just like, you know, when you begin meditation, you think, oh, I'm just going to really relax now. And you sit down and then it's, you know, all the thoughts start flooding in, the to-do list, the pain in the knee, you know. It doesn't mm-hmm. end up being all that relaxing, you know, when you're first starting.
Right. Well, when you're speaking of meditation, I know a big component of your work is also bringing in kind of what I call the mindfulness aspect, the awareness of self as well as other and those kind of things. Could you just for a minute or two just tell everyone listening why do you think that is of such crucial importance?
Yeah. Well, it really gets back to the kind of state that it creates. You know, this this attention into the environment does several things. I think I mentioned it primes, I think, for that ventral vagal system, which is this social mm-hmm. engagement, this engagement curiosity. But it also interrupts the what's wrong attention. So if the amygdala, the smoke detector is going off, and then I can get my attention into the external environment, I stop reinforcing the what's wrong attention. And I get back to the what is attention. And just interrupting that kind of negative cycle of what's wrong and what the problem is itself just a huge benefit. And in fact, most people after my first training would probably say that that most simple piece, this connecting to the environment through the senses, is probably the single most potent intervention that they get. And they're really surprised at how rapidly people begin to stabilize with that process. And it's counterintuitive because for those of us who are psychotherapists or for mindfulness practitioners, we're often taught to go inside, mm-hmm. go toward our feelings, go toward our understanding, go toward our sensation, something. But in fact, it's the ability to effortlessly get the attention into the external environment that is so key because it interrupts cycles of intensity that would otherwise be disorienting and disorganizing.
Yeah, exactly. Now, this term, we started our conversation, I mentioned your work about fostering resilience. Mm-hmm. Could you kind of talk a little bit about, it's a great word, and we all, we want our clients to have resilience and all that. What do you think, as therapists, we need to really be doing to, and on a case-by-case basis, putting that aside, to help foster resilience within our clients?
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly, you know, that positive interpersonal sphere that we think is important is probably surely important. You know, that unconditional positive regard, the empathy, congruence, and if we can come up with a non-pathologizing environment as a part of that, wouldn't that be a really nifty thing? Mm-hmm. One in which the client and the sort of the hierarchical dimension between client and clinician is diminished somehow. That would be a nice thing. But I think yes. The other thing that I draw a distinction about is what I call a phase two versus phase three intervention. And the phase two are things that we can be doing. Good ideas, you know, CBT, DBT, mindfulness, belly breathing, all the things that we can be doing that will help a person get control over their state. You know, meditation, mantras, anything that helps a person, you know, anything besides, you know, something addictive, that helps a person have some feeling of control over their unruly states. Those are going to aid in resilience. But most people define resilience primarily or almost exclusively in those terms, like what you should do to feel better if you feel like you're losing resilience or what you need to do to feel okay on an ongoing basis. So that's an important element. But for me, resilience and the organic intelligence approach is the ability of the biology to process intensity effortlessly. And I believe that we've figured out a bit about how the biology in its effort to self-organize actually increases its range of effortless processing so that the person's system itself processes intensity of emotion or thought or sensation or any intensity, can process that or contain it without the person having to resort to techniques and tools or these phase two tools of resiliency. And I think it's that intrinsic resiliency that we should also focus on. And I'm part of a coalition that's looking at stress and resiliency in the context of global climate change. And what I hope to be contributing to this field of resiliency is this understanding of intrinsic biological resiliency that is a necessary complement to the kinds of tools, tips, and tricks that people can learn in order to help themselves get control over their uncomfortable states.
Right. Yeah. If you're kind of looking at a system, and we'll say it's, let's say you're working with a family, and one of the family members has been traumatized for, you know, some kind of outside of the family event came into the family system and created this trauma. Do you find that, like some of the people from the past that we talked about earlier, who were the early kind of systemic thinkers, that it is important to attend to all members of the family and try to, you know, even though, because now, you know, trauma is such a, I mean, it's the hot thing, as they say, in the psychotherapy marketplace, but it seems to be very individualized in a lot of the teaching, the trainings. So would you still kind of operate from that family system view of dealing with that traumatized family member?
Yeah, I sure would. And you'd probably agree on this, that those symptoms of trauma, although they may come in from the individual, they're held and bound and reinforced within that system.
Yes.
So you're
yes.
really looking at how is that reinforced and beginning to try to find an alternative input into the system. And so I'm for sure going to be looking for who's holding the resource, right? And how can we begin to get a look on the resource? We're not going to gloss over the suffering. We're not going to be unempathetic about the challenge, but I'm going to be looking for who's got the idea, who's got the affect, who's got the movement that is actually contributing to the expansion of the system rather than its contraction.
Mm-hmm.
And that may be the person who is traumatized. That may be, you know, anybody else in that group. I would just get mighty curious about how that was going to happen.
Yeah. So I guess some takeaways I'm getting is a big foundation for you is curiosity. And is that kind of how you approach at this stage of your life? Do you kind of approach life in that perspective now as well outside the therapy room?
Oh, man, I am so enjoying my life. And honest to God, if you knew my life experience, you would know that there's no good reason for this. But I just really enjoy it, and I have a spirit of this curiosity that's ongoing. And I think it was Martin Luther who said, "If we could but see a grain of wheat, we would go mad with wonder."
Yeah, it is. I again, this is just me, and I think you and I are kind of kindred spirits on this systemic view. It's like the more we see things systemically in our life, in our world, those. False boundaries and barriers just kind of fall away. Mm-hmm. And, you know, things that happen, although, yes, we place them in a category of unpleasant. But then when we really look at this grander interconnection, it's just kind of it's fascinating. And I'm always a surprise. Let's put it that way.
me too. And I love that. And in some ways, I think of it as just the seeing the beauty of, Mandelbrot, right, who coined this term fractal. And and really seeing nature from this fractal perspective, it is just so beautiful. You know,
mm-hmm.
You see the unfolding and the reiteration of patternings that occur. And so, for instance, I'll train my folks to see the human biology in its fractal expression and see when it's becoming more reiterative in its organizational phase and so on. But it's fascinating just to see this beauty because it's us, right? I mean, mm-hmm. this amazing fractal nature, that is us too, and we are thoroughly embedded in nature. We're not going to nature. We are nature, and so I'm thrilled to be a part of it. And frankly, Paul, jazzed to be connected with you in that way.
Oh, thank you. Well, as we about to wrap this conversation that could probably go on for far too long, I'd like people to kind of know where the best way they can find out about you, your trainings. I know you're doing a lot of international trainings as well. Mm-hmm. Can you kind of tell them the best way to find you and kind of some of the things you're offering lately?
You bet. You know, the thing that I'm doing now is really realizing that the subtlety and the nuance of the biological observation is really key. Like seeing a person, seeing a body, seeing a biology, there are a ton of different observations that one could make. And so we need to have some coaching on what's relevant and what moment and how to begin to decode the complex interactions that are occurring with every breath and every bat of an eye and every change of coloration and muscle tension and so on. So I've created both live trainings and then online components with them that have a lot of video feedback options and feedback options for people's training experience. So really trying to leverage technology for the sake of humanity. And so those trainings are available online, but they're also in various locations around the world. I'd say the best avenue to find that would just be the website, Organic Intelligence. And if you want to see an example of me working, there is thejadavideo.com. And that's me working. My daughter was, I guess she was three. She's nine now. And we had gone to San Diego Airport. We're going on vacation. And long story short, she'd gotten into the fountain there in Terminal 2 and got a coin stuck in her throat. And I saw this happening, and I quickly turned her upside down and gave her some really supportive pats between the shoulder blades. And she, you know, she was fine, except that, you know, about 11:30 that night at San Diego Children's Hospital, she was anesthetized, and they took out two pennies out of her throat.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. Oh, and still the two most expensive pennies in all of San Diego County.
I bet.
And so the next morning we were having breakfast, and because we've been going on vacation, I had a video camera with me, and she started to do this, this kind of choking game. So in a 6.5 minute segment, I go through that with her seeing her move through this fight, flight, and freeze pattern and then come back into social engagement, all through simply reinforcing the elements of her psyche that were very positive, that were helping her negotiate it. Like she would talk about her brother Jacob and her friend Julia. So the jadavideo.com, I think that could be really interesting for folks as well. And just get a little sample of how to work in a really naturalistic fashion with trauma in a way that's not traumatic. And in fact, doesn't even reference trauma. You call this an implicit exposure model. We're just doing this free association conversation and then watching as the system tells you how it wants to unfold, sometimes without even naming the trauma at all.
Yeah, that's great. Oh, that's so wonderful. Listen, I want to thank you so much for talking to me today, my friend. And it's always a pleasure to chat, and we've got to do it again in the future soon.
I feel the same. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Potential Not Pathology with Dr. Paul J. Leslie. If you enjoyed the show, check out our website at potentialnotpathology.com, where you will find programs and articles showcasing unique and creative therapeutic applications.